Like a chrysalis, we're emerging from the economy of the Industrial Revolution. An economy confined to and limited by the Earth's physical resources, into the economy in mind, in which there are no bounds on human imagination, and the freedom to create is the most precious natural resource.
Welcome to The Soul of Enterprise, Business and the Knowledge Economy, sponsored by Sage, transforming the way people think and work, enabling their organizations to thrive. I'm Ron Baker, along with my good friend and VeriSage Institute colleague, Ed Klass. And on today's show, folks, what are we doing, Ed?
Glorious Gallimaufry.
Glorious Gallimaufry. Okay, great.
Come on.
What does that mean?
It's another word for potpourri, for hodgepodge, for miscellany, you know. So we've done a couple of these shows. I try to come up with something different each time. So Gallimaufry was up this week.
Okay, fair enough. God, it's like being on the air with William F. Buckley. I tried to keep topics sort of related to business. So I've got maybe a couple that are outside, but. Let me give you. I can't believe I'm doing this. I've got two in the stack from Harvard Business Review, Ed, and you know how much I love HBR. Oh, God, but this one wasn't bad. And okay. The title is it's by Tim Ryan. It's from April 2nd, 2024. HBR CEOs, is your business strategy bold enough? I like it. I like it.
Good title. Good title.
So he says 45% of CEOs surveyed in PwC's 27th annual global CEO survey said they do not believe their companies would survive more than a decade if they remain on their current path. That's almost half.
Wow.
That's kind of interesting. And the most important question a CEO needs to ask themselves today, is my strategy bold enough and do I have the right team to execute it? And if you can't confidently say yes, then here are four key actions you can take. So then he gives his four key actions.
Okay.
One, objectively assess your company's position. It requires an understanding that it might be like what it might be like to be your competitor's customer so you can spot differences firsthand. And then second step, lean into reinvention. Several megatrends and macroeconomic forces put many of us at a critical crossroads. Either reinvent or be disrupted. To be clear, business model reinvention is hard. Yeah, no kidding. Business model reinvention can include transforming a traditional product to a subscription-based or software-enabled. And then he gives other examples. Third, assess your leadership team alignment. Ask yourself if you have the right team and the right culture for change. Business model reinvention cannot happen if your leadership team isn't clear on the mission. Cultivate an environment of trust, healthy debate, and then it's important to respectfully hear different perspectives, gather alignment, and move forward as a unified front. And then the last one is take action. Bold agendas are not about having the courage to reimagine and then reinvent the way you do business, or are about having the courage to reimagine and then reinvent the way you do business. It requires introspection, humility, and vulnerability. Complacency is a risk few can afford. Business model reinvention demands courage. And I thought, yeah, this is so true. Most strategy isn't a strategy.
It's a plan.
It's a budget.
Yeah, it's a budget.
The plan becomes a budget of a way of budgeting or forecasting. And I think this is right on. And we both know that business model reinvention is incredibly difficult. That's why we can only find a few examples of companies that have done it successfully. I talk about Target. You know, in my book, Dayton Hudson, creating a new entity. And by the way, when they did that, they were at the top financially. They were doing really well. There was no reason for them to do that other than the CEO is looking down the road going, we're going to get squeezed in the future with you know, Sears and Walmart and Kmart. Walmart wasn't even on their radar when they made that move. And it was a brilliant thing he did. And then Charles Schwab did the same thing when it went from brick and mortar to online. But both of them spun out new entities. Mm-hmm. And both CEOs said, and this is all retold in a Clayton Christensen Harvard course, that both CEOs said, this would have never happened unless we created a brand new firm. Because it didn't have legacy, it didn't have the old mindset, it was a new profit model, new business model, everything about it was different. So I absolutely love that, even though it came from HBR.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, just it gets back to what we've been harping on and for I guess the greater part of a year now, Ron, and that is that strategy is not strategic planning, and planning, as you said, is usually budgeting. And that we get, and I was caught up in this too. It's like, what's the strategy? And I always struggle with it. And a strategy is usually just a simple phrase or word, or it's like, digital transformation. That's a strategy. We're going to, but what does that mean? How does that manifest itself in your organization? And that's the picture you've got to paint.
Right. Where are we going to play? And I kind of hate the win-loss thing, but where are we going to play and how are we going to win? That's a strategy. I mean, when Howard Moran did, MD Square, the strategy was, hey, we're going to limit each doctor to 50 patients, and it's going to be a premium, $24,000 a year service. Everybody heard that strategy and thought he was nuts, I'm sure everybody heard Herb Kelleher's strategy for Southwest. We're going to fly the same plane. We're going to go out of tertiary airports. We're not going to serve food. We're not going to have different classes. We're not going to fly international. That sounds like a crazy strategy back in, whenever he devised it in the 70s. Now, of course, they're one of the most profitable airlines and have been for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So really putting that pin on it to say, okay, what are we going to do? And sticking with it. I mean, that's the other thing I see is that far too many organizations, especially large ones, their strategies are all over the map. Yes, they do have something that I would consider a strategy, but sometimes it's too many things. This is to your point too, is like, how many KPIs are you checking on this to be able to do this?
Right. How many niches do you have? Yeah. How many targeted segments do you have? Yeah. I would say a lot of firms don't have a clear strategy. Mm-hmm. If they do, it's kind of by default, and that's like having a by default pricing strategy, which is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, Ron. So this is an interesting thing because it is related to something that you have been talking about for 30 years. One of the opening chapters of your early book was, why is movie popcorn so expensive?
Yes.
Right? Yep. So this is not about movie popcorn per se, but this is an analysis from statsignificant.com, S-T-A-T, significant.com. Are movies better when they're watched in theaters? Mm. And they did a statistical analysis of this, and this is the money quote. There is a 2-5% uplift in movie enjoyment when viewed in theaters, but what's the monetary value of that amusement? Is it 2-5% uptick in entertainment value for leaving your house, driving somewhere, paying $20 a ticket, watching 20 minutes of trailers, and receiving a functionally pointless thank you from Nicole Kidman for entering the theater? For me, the answer is yes. That's the incremental 2-5% means the world to me. So pretty interesting that now that is not a huge number, but they did say it. We definitely find it in the numbers, in the stats. We're seeing an uplift that there is greater enjoyment when you watch it in the theater and not at home. Well, there you go.
It's interesting. I had a story in the stack. Yeah, I don't have it anymore, but it was about movie theaters and the ones that are really, really kicking butt with dramatically increased attendance coming out of COVID are IMAX theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And this is around the world, by the way. And a lot of these, they have the nice comfy chairs. They have, service. They'll bring you the popcorn and the goodies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have speed dating in the lobby, and some of them have bars and all of that. And they're doing really well.
Yep.
I think going to a theater is probably a better experience, at least if it's a movie that is cool on the big screen. And most of them are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially that makes a difference, like Oppenheimer or something like that. So, yeah.
Right. And I would imagine Barbie would be much better on a big screen than.
Did not see Barbie, so I don't know. Yeah. I'll say yes. I do know that Oppenheimer was great and it was important that it was on the big screen. And right. I did see the Napoleon movie, and it was. it was okay on the big screen. It was well shot, but it was still horrific, horrible movie. I mean, just historically completely inaccurate. You know, Napoleon bombing or shooting cannon at the pyramids. I'm like, what? What?
Yeah, I listened to a podcast with Andrew Roberts, the great British historian, and it was Uncommon Knowledge with Peter Robinson, and he was blasting the Napoleon movie just for its historical inaccuracies. Beautiful movie, he said. You know, well shot and scenes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh yeah, yes, exactly, correct,
and all that. But he said, from a historical standpoint, it was a nightmare. And he said, I guess he criticized the director and said, you know, why didn't you consult with or have a consultant historian to help you with this? And the director's snarky comment was, well, were you there?
Yes, that's Ridley Scott. No.
Yeah, Ridley Scott. Yeah, not the smartest thing to say to a historian. No, none of them were there. But that doesn't mean they don't know anything, especially this guy. My God, he's an encyclopedia.
Yeah. So, Ron, do you have a short one? Because I have a short one that I can probably do in under 2 minutes because we only got two left. Okay, so I just think this was a really smart idea that the New York Times sent out an email to me. I am a subscriber. I've been a subscriber for about 6 months now. My low price is about to run out, and I'm trying to decide whether or not I should renew. And I don't know if this is something that was sent to me at this point, because I know the renewal is coming up in a short period of time, or this is something that they've introduced to all of their subscribers. But now you can now share unlimited articles that recipients can read for free, which I thought was really smart.
Now that's really smart.
So if you send it to the link to someone, it allows them to see the story. You know, this is behind a paywall. I can't see this. So I thought that this was a really interesting way that they have plussed the offering. And I hope others follow suit, especially things like The Economist. You frequently send some stuff to me in The Economist. I'm like, can't get in. All right, I'll PDF it for you. And then say, so this is a really smart idea. If you send it from a subscriber to someone who's a non-subscriber, they get to view it for free. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. God, I hope you re-up it then. Because I'll have access to the New York Times, because I always see great articles and I can't get to them because I kind of refuse to pay for the thing, but that would be great.
So. Yep. So there we go. But want to remind folks that they can get a hold of Ron or me by sending an email to asktsoe@verisage.com. Of course, the website is The Soul of Enterprise. There you can see show notes as well as previews to upcoming shows. We do have all previous shows that are out there, and that would be all 484 of them. This is the 485th show today. But right now, a word from our sponsors, including our folks at 90 Minds. Find a mind at 90minds.com.
Follow Voice America at facebook.com/Voice America for juicy updates from your favorite radio shows and podcasts.
Have you ever read a book that changed your life? I sure have. Have you ever listened to an advertisement for a book so many times that you question the existence of God? Me too. Hello, I'm Greg Kite. I recorded the advertisement for Ron and Ed's book, The Soul of Enterprise Dialogues on Blah, 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 Whatever. And 4 years later, we're all tired of it, especially me. But thankfully, there's a solution. For just $10 a month, you never have to hear my voice again. For a commercial-free version of The Soul of Enterprise, go to patreon.com/TSOE and subscribe now.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Kless. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using hashtag AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
Well, welcome back, everybody. We're doing Glorious Gallimaufry. So, Ed, I've got one in here from Andrew Stuttiford, prior TSOE guest, talking about electric vehicles, cell phones, EVs, and Pete Buttigieg. So this is interesting because it kind of ties in with my first story about, is your strategy bold enough? Buttigieg, as you know, former McKinsey guy. Mm-hmm. I don't have more to say about that. He's our, Secretary of Transportation, right?
That's correct, yes.
He said this regarding EVs. Let's be clear. The automotive sector is moving toward EVs, and we can't pretend otherwise. Sometimes when these debates happen, I feel like it's the early 2000s, and I'm talking to some people who think that we can just have landline phones forever. And Andrew, man, just destroys this, talking about, you know, for one technology to supplant another, it has to have an incredible, you know, Drucker thought 10 times improvement in performance, cost, affordability, you know, right? All of this turns into countless virtual circles. And Stutterford points out, no one banned the horse. the automobile replaced it because it was better, right?
Right, right.
The current state of technology supporting infrastructure for EVs represents a step back for most drivers, not in advance. And he talks about cell phones. We're also not, you know, we didn't outlaw the landline when we started trying to move to cell phones. Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, landlines are still pretty popular. He gives some of the numbers. I won't get into it. But Jack Butler, Jonah Goldberg's former, amanuensis, says this about Buttigieg. He says he disdains anyone who might prefer gas-powered cars. It's an argument that only could come from someone accustomed to viewing customers, people, as data sets to be analyzed or manipulated. So we shouldn't be surprised to see it come from, he calls him McKinsey Pete. It's a great moniker. Governments did not have to encourage the take-up of cell phones with subsidies or proposing to ban or squeeze out the sale of new traditional phones. This is central planning with these EVs, and it's coming down the pike and they're trying to force it. And it's just, this is not how markets work. Markets work by competitive, you know, dynamics. And if this was left to the market, not only would EVs get better and probably faster, but combustion engines would continue to improve, as would hybrids and would possibly other types of alternative vehicles, hydrogen or whatever. But man, we're moving all the chips on the table to EVs. And it's a huge mistake. This is not a market. This is the government mandating this. This isn't driven by consumers.
Yeah. Again, once the government gets involved in pricing or supply and demand, however you want to phrase it, there's always going to be things upset. In fact, my next story, unless you've got anything else is specifically about that too. This is about the new California wage law that is now in effect on the whole fast food thing. This one, unsurprisingly, this story is probably behind the paywall of the Dispatch, so I can't. The headline is California's new fast food wage law will probably end badly. We just don't know how. But here's some things that are already happening. One, Pizza Hut and Roundtable Pizza franchises have said they plan to lay off around 1,280 delivery drivers this year. Papa John's has done the same. They're going to discontinue delivery service entirely or shift it to the outside delivery service because of rising costs. The owner of the two Vitality Bowls restaurants in San Jose now runs his stores with two employees versus four because he typically has in the past. It takes longer to make customer orders of the bowls and other orders and is raising prices around 10% to help cover the increased labor. Other California restaurants are reducing hours, closing or slowing during parts of the day that take where there's less time. They're embracing automation. automation. California-based El Palo Loco told investors this month that it was automating some of its salsa making as it grapples with the anticipated wage inflation of 10 to 14%. Jack in the Box is testing fryer robots and automated drink dispensers to reduce the labor cost. The owner of several Auntie Anne's and Cinnabon restaurants in California said that thanks to almost $500,000 in annual labor costs, he's reduced his staff by about 10. It brought in his 73-year-old parents to help out. And turned a recent offer to add a location on the waterfront, turned down an offer to add a recent location on the waterfront in San Francisco. McDonald's, Chipotle, Mexican Grill, Jack in the Box, Wingstop, and other chains are also say they plan to raise menu prices to compensate for the wage. And that's even before the law has gone into effect.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. The one that you said, towards the beginning was Roundtable. Mm-hmm. They have great pizza. Mm-hmm. So that's going to affect me, but
you'll have to go out and pick it up, Ron, or yeah, or DoorDash it.
Yeah, DoorDash. And DoorDash is kind of pricey.
Really? Yeah.
And have you noticed, I don't know, is this true in Texas? Now my grocery store wants me to tip the driver.
Oh, and if you order
and they actually put it, you know, as you're ordering on the website, you know, filling up your cart, they're computing a tip. And of course you can adjust it, but I might've missed it a few times, you know, I don't even know when they began this, but it's not, they expect like, you know, 17, 20, 30 bucks tip, depending on how big your order is.
Yeah. And well, which is interesting because that kind of flies in the face of what a lot of people are, or a lot of the grocery stores are finding that the margins are better on call in orders.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure they are.
You know,
but they're saying that, you know, our drivers rely on tips. And it's like, really? You don't pay your drivers enough? They have to have tips. I mean, to me, it just, I don't know. This is outside of custom, I think.
Yeah.
I think they're going to get blowback from this.
Yeah. I think that it's possible that tipping custom starts to change significantly. There have been some articles written about tipping that I've seen is we're over tipped, or we've reached peak tip. Right. there was even a meme down here in Texas that's right at the eclipse was happening. It was replaced by a tip box. How much do you want to tip?
It started when Uber, you know, started flashing it on your screen and giving you the choice that started at like 20%, right?
Well, you know, and that was, but at least there's a history of that, because you would tip your cab driver, right? Absolutely. So now, but remember when Uber first started, it was all Uber Black. Yes. Right? It was just Uber Black, and there was no tipping. That was actually one of the side benefits, is that you were not allowed to and weren't supposed to tip, even in cash. Right. And what is interesting is that I have had to take Uber Black on some occasions when, like, in weird situations, it was the only thing that was really available. And now Uber Black, if you take an Uber Black, it still asks if you want a tip. And I say no. If it's an Uber Black, I'm paying Uber Black prices. I am not tipping. That's supposed to be part of the deal.
Yeah, that's already at the luxury level, right?
Uh-huh. So, yep.
Well, I've got something here from The Economist, March 25th. Have McKinsey and its consulting rivals got too big? It's kind of interesting because it's talking about the future. So it talks about Bain, BCG, Boston Consulting Group, and McKinsey. That's the big four, if you include Accenture, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you have the big four accounting firms consulting arm. So there's really a great eight here, they call them. Mm-hmm. Accenture grew by 20% in 2021, but then it dropped to 13% last year in 2022. And growth has been soggy for the great eight, slowing to around 5% in 2023. So this is a cause for headaches for consultants. Revenue at McKinsey is up by one third since 2019, but their headcount is up by half to 45,000. Layoffs have become widespread. Last year, Accenture got rid of 19,000 people. And, you know, they say, look, these consulting firms, they've made it through choppy waters before, yet the recovery this time is complicated by three issues. And these are interesting. The first is geopolitics. You know, McKinsey's provided advice to the Chinese government that helps shape its Made in China 2025 plan. I'm sure you've seen that, right? We talked about that. some American lawmakers are so pissed off they want to ban McKinsey from getting any American government contracts because of their work in China, because McKinsey denied it, and even though people found it on their website and all of that. So there's that going on. The PwC is being scrutinized by the Chinese government for audit failures at Evergrande, you know, the property developer. So there's that going on. And then the second thing, they talk about the waning enthusiasm for ESG because of the blowback against ESG. In 2021, McKinsey acquired 3 ESG consultancies. Accenture gobbled up 5. They seem to be paying off, but the economist says whether that growth will continue at the same pace is not clear. Sustainability projects ranked 10th in their list of CEO's priorities for the year, down from number 4. So clients are reining in their climate ambitions. And then the third and thorniest challenge is technological change. And I thought this was interesting too. They've all made massive investments and earned great fees from consulting on AI. McKinsey has launched Lily, a ChatGPT-like bot trained on its intellectual property. Accenture has booked $1.1 billion worth of generative AI work in the past 6 months. But here's what the economist says. The quicker corporate clients become comfortable with chatbots, the faster they may simply go directly to the makers in Silicon Valley. If that happens, the grade 8 short-term gains from AI could lead them towards irrelevance. That is something for all the strategy brains to stew on. That's kind of interesting. You know, we're seeing more and more tech firms move in and take over things. And, you know, even some auditing functions. Now, there still has to be a CPA involved, but the tech firm can do, you know, the heavy lifting, and the CPA can just come in and review and sign. And there's a lot of that's a really interesting, I think, development.
Well, that's what Harris was talking about in terms of, you know, continuous audit in the process. Of course, the AI can perform the function of an audit. It can do it in real enough time, not necessarily real time, but real enough time. And then, he submits that there's more, if accountants play their cards right, there would be more work for the accountant, because then they could focus on the advice piece. Will they?
No.
Can they make the transition?
Not if history is a guide. You know, we're going to save you all this time so you can move up the value curve. And all it's done is we're going to go out and get the same type of work that can be automated. And, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Right. So anyway. you're saying no, they're not going to be able to make that leap. My quote: Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 3, Line 87. No.
I don't anticipate that. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're up against our break. I want to remind you that you can contact Ron or me by sending an email to ask. That's ASKTSOE@verisage.com. We would love to hear from you, as always. Our show is sponsored by, we also have a Patreon channel, I should say, and that Patreon channel is sponsored by several folks, including 90Mind, who I talked about in the last break, but it's also sponsored by Blake Oliver at Earmark CPE. Check him out and work that he is doing at earmarkcpe.com. Also, want you to rate this podcast by going to ratethispodcast.com/TSOE. There you can rate the podcast. We promise folks to read any and all reviews that you do provide for us out there, so we'd love for you to do that. But right now, a word from our sponsors.
Enjoying our shows and can't get enough of us? Follow us on Instagram at Voice America Talk Radio and see what we're cooking up for you.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Have you ever listened to an online radio show that changed your life? I'm required to say that I have. Have you ever stopped listening to an online radio show because the commercials were mind-numbingly repetitive? Of course you haven't, because you're here right now. Look, you don't have to listen to me anymore. There's a commercial-free version of this show, and it only costs $10 a month. And for $15 a month, you get no commercials plus bonus content. Go to patreon.com/TSOE, subscribe now, and be free. You're worth it.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Klass. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using hashtag AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
And we are back on the Solar Enterprise. We are talking today about glorious Gallimaufry. And Ron, my next entry into glorious Gallimaufry is, from of all places, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System.
All right. My favorite.
So, yeah. Now, the whole thing is not available. You have to, of course, subscribe here and sign in and paper library and old PDF, etc. But I will read the summary. The title of this is, Has Intergenerational Progress Stalled? Income Growth Over Five Generations of Americans. And this is by Kevin Corinth from the University of Chicago and Jeff Larimore, who is a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. This is the abstract available on the website. We find that each of the past four generations of Americans was better off than the previous one using a post-tax, post-transfer income measure constructed annually from 1963 to 2022 based on current population survey annual social and economic supplement. At age 36 to 40, millennials had a real median income that was 18% higher than that of the previous generation of the same age. This rate of intergenerational progress was slower than expected by experienced by the Silent Generation, 34%, Baby Boomers, 27%, but similar to that experienced by Gen X, which is 16%. Slower progress for Gen X and Millennials is due to their stalled growth in work hours. Holding work hours constant, they experienced a greater intergenerational increase in real market income than Baby Boomers. Intergenerational progress for Millennials under 30 has remained robust as well, although their income growth results largely from higher reliance on their parents. We also find that higher educational costs incurred by younger generations is far outweighed by their lifetime income gains. So, you know, that there was a meme that was going around the last 2 weeks about, you know, the this is real productivity is going up and the real wage thing that was stagnating and going flat. Horse hockey, as Colonel Potter would say.
Yep. I know. Yeah. And, you know, the Federal Reserve does a lot of great research. So that's great. Yeah.
I still disapprove of the Federal Reserve System.
I agree. I understand. And, but they have so many economists hanging around.
Yeah,
they got to do something. Yeah. But one of the things I really relied on them for was so they do some longitudinal studies where they track the same people over time. And that really makes a big difference when you're looking at all these income statistics, because we're not talking about the same people in these brackets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, yep. So, well, that's cool. Well, Ed, I got one. This is from Fast Company from April 1st. And it's Wharton experts analyzed this company's 4-day work week pilot. Here's what they learned. And this is Exos, EXOS, is a coaching company. The firm partnered with two experts from Wharton to pilot 4-week program. Retention rates dramatically improved. Employee turnover went from 47% to 29%. A full 91% of employees said they believed they spent their time effectively at work. Of course, what else would you expect them to say?
Right.
Compared to only 67% prior to the scheduling switch. Only 36% reported feeling burned out, and prior 70%. So it cut that almost in half. They implemented intentional scheduling, meeting auditing, daily micro breaks, and other tactics, maintaining business effectiveness. The sales pipeline grew by 211%, and they have forecasts for expected revenue growth. The employees were not only happier, they were just as effective during these short work weeks. The initial trial was from July to December of 2023, and the company is going to continue the program. I don't have it with me, but Kevin Hassett at National Review wrote about this, the four-day work week, because of what Bernie Sanders said.
Right.
And he said, expect to see a lot of research in the coming months about how great this is. And his point, look, if this is so great for companies, then you don't need a law to, you know, enforce it. Just like if EVs are so great, you don't need to ban.
That's correct.
You know, and he pointed out so many of the studies that were done so far have not been able to be replicated anywhere, and they were deeply flawed, especially when you talk about revenue growth, because the base year is, you know, probably COVID. When your revenue was at a nadir, and now, you know, it's coming back up. So cause and effect is all sorts of screwed up here, you know, cause and correlation. So, but do expect to see a lot more hype around the 4-day work week.
Oh yeah. No, I, but that's definitely coming. And look, I think there are going to be companies that try it out and it may be effective for them. Look, we had a 6-day work week for a long time too. Like,
absolutely.
And that was moved to 5 days. And these are just cultural things that change over time. But they're also an example of wealth. I mean, it just the superabundance. That's what this is an example of.
Absolutely. Right? Yep.
So,
I'll tell you one for sure way that you will not get a 4-day work week. And that is if your firm bills by the hour. Every firm that's been part of these pilot samples that bills by the hour said, this didn't work out.
It didn't work. It didn't work for us. We don't know why. Yeah. So, 'cause our revenue is down by 20%. It was amazing. I just couldn't figure it out.
Probably no. Probably 10%, but you know, 'cause Fridays aren't as billable, but you know,
Well, there are. I know our friends at Chris Vanover. They've got a 4-day work week at Audit Club now, CPA Club. By the way, I don't know if you saw that, caught that they moved to 4-day. And you know the way they structure it, I remember you talking, is you can either do Monday or Friday. So that's the way they do it because they have to provide coverage for their customers for the five days for right now. So they allow people to shift all those things over. All right. So this one harkens back to our guest from, oh gosh, was it 5 years ago now or so? Azra Reza, the first cell.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So here's an update on this. This is from The Guardian. Cancer signs could be spotted years before symptoms, says a new research institute. So this is scientists at a recently opened cancer center at Cambridge University have begun work that is pinpointing changes in cells as many years before they develop into tumors. The research is helping to design radically new ways to treat cancer. The Early Cancer Institute, which has received £11 million from an anonymous donor, is focused on finding ways to tackle tumors before they produce symptoms. The research will exploit recent discoveries, which have shown that many people develop precancerous conditions that lie in abeyance for long periods. So nothing specific out of here now, but just, you know, some specific research that's being done into the area that Dr. Reza was hoping for, which I think is fantastic that we're spending some money on not how to cure cancer once we have it, but how to detect it and perhaps prevent it from getting out of hand from the very beginning. Her work, of course, in a book entitled The First Cell was an appeal to just that. So wanted to follow up on that and say I think that's some good news.
Awesome. I would love to talk to her and see what she's been up to, because she was also working on that and trying to raise money. And I would just love a status update from her. And I wonder if AI is going to accelerate this process at all.
I think that that's possible. I got another thing on AI that is related to that.
Go ahead.
So this is AI can find billions of new antibiotics, even for superbugs that don't respond to treatments. This is from ZM Science. Their work there. Let's see. I wasn't prepared to do this, so give me a second here. A recent study published in Nature Machine Intelligence by McAllister Magazine and Stanford, a generative AI model capable of designing new antibiotics to combat drug-resistant bacteria. So it is already showing some signs that it is working. The World Health Organization is happy about this. Take that as it may. But yeah, it's showing some pretty good signs that this is making significant strides over the last mile problem in healthcare, ensuring that patients follow through with prescribed treatments and lifestyle changes. So usually it's pretty good stuff.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yep. Yep.
Well, so. This is not a short enough one to get in all of it in this segment, but I'm going to start it anyway.
Okay. Again,
this is my second entry from Harvard Business Review.
Oh, my gosh. This is a record.
It. Yes, it is. This is from January 5th, 2021. So it's a bit old. It's by Daniel Markovitz, and its title is Productivity is About Your Systems, Not Your People. And he talks about time management, the inbox zero, you know, the Pomodoro technique, the Eisenhower matrix, right? The important, mm-hmm. critical, all of that. He said all these productivity hacks, just don't hack it. And he goes back to Edwards Deming, argued in his book, Out of the Crisis, that 94% of most problems and possibilities for improvement belong to the system, not the individual. Mm. Sound familiar?
Yep.
Global optimization versus local optimization.
Yep.
But there's some things in here, Ed, that I think kind of apply to, you know, are kind of project management-y type ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really curious about your thoughts on this. But here are four countermeasures that will help, he says, increase productivity. Daily huddles. But he breaks it down. He said the first huddle should consist of frontline workers that begins at the start of the workday. Now, this is what Ritz-Carlton does,
mm-hmm.
right? Everybody that comes in on a shift, they pick one of the 20 basics and they go over just one of them, right? So you can ask any Ritz-Carlton employee, what was today's basic? And they'll be mm-hmm. able to tell you.
Right.
He said the next huddle consists of supervisors, and these huddles are about 30 minutes. And then later, the managers meet for 30 minutes, followed by directors and VPs, and finally the executive team. So I just thought this idea of a work huddle was interesting. Mm-hmm. OBK used to do this. The team would stand up in the morning, they'd ring a bell. Everybody would stand up with their tea or whatever. And it was just like 10 minutes. And they just went around the whole team really quick talking about, what are you working on today? Do you have any client appointments? And do you need help with anything?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they could share things. So I kind of like this idea of the morning huddle or whatever.
Right. Yeah. It's an after action review or before action review. It's really bringing culture. I've seen organizations that have done these stand up morning meetings and I think they're great. I do think they're effective. I think they're more effective in the small and medium business than they are in the large company. Mm-hmm. But I mean, depending upon the team that you're trying to service inside the large company, I could see it working there too, but it depends on how the team is structured.
Right. Right. Well, this is great. Well, we'll keep going with this because I want to talk to you about the other three recommendations too. But in the meantime, folks, if you want to get a hold of me or Ed, send us an email to asktsoe@verisage.com. Go out and rate our podcast. You can do this at ratethispodcast/TSOE. And now a word from our sponsors and Ed's employer, Sage.
A little birdie told me Voice America is on X. At Voice America TRN.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Have you ever been so annoyed by a commercial for a $5 ebook that you were willing to pay $10 to never hear it again? I sure have. Hello, I'm Greg Kite. Over the last several years, you've come to hate me, and I hate me too. By now, you know that for $5, you can get a copy of Ron and Ed's book. What you might not know is, for twice that much every month for forever, you can stop hearing me plug Ron and Ed's book, which totally makes sense, like the Diamond Water Paradox. Go to patreon.com/TSOE and subscribe today. Please, for the love of God, make it stop!
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Klass. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using hashtag AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
Welcome back, everybody. We're doing our glorious Gallimaufry. And Ed, I've been talking about this Harvard Business Review article, Productivity is About Your Systems, Not Your People. And if you want to improve your system, this guy, the author here, Daniel Markovitz, gives four countermeasures that will help. And we talked about the first one, tier your huddles. So have a morning huddle. And he also talks about make work visible, physical or virtual task boards, such as Trello, Asana, Airtable, Zenkit, where every task is represented by a card specifying who is handling it and its status. And that I thought of your issues list, you know, everything's assigned and you can see exactly where it is and all of that. But this one was really interesting. Define the bat signal. This is specified channels for urgent versus non-urgent issues. And I thought this was really interesting that he suggests you have, you know, if somebody hits you up on like Slack or whatever, that means it's urgent. And something else is just, you know, everyday type banter or whatever. And I thought that was a kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah. I mean, I like it's triage, right? It's the concept of triage is just and based on what the individual believes that or the professional, you know, we're big on, you know what, Ron, let's give professionals a use to exercise their judgment.
Judgment. Like, yes. Absolutely. And then
who defines urgent? The person who thinks it's urgent. That's
He also talks about align responsibility with authority. He's, you know, and this is such a common problem. We talked about this with multiple guests over the years. Too often workers are made responsible for tasks, but aren't given the authority to deliver the results. This causes frustration, stress, overburden. He gives the example of W.L. Gore and Associates. You know, they have a lattice structure organization. Mm-hmm. Gore is an amazing company. I've always just loved studying it. But they allow employees to make what they call above the waterline decisions, meaning low risk. But if it's a below the waterline, meaning high risk decision, then they might have to get approval from somewhere else in the organization. So I thought that was a really good point. But, you know, he's right about this. I mean, productivity is more about your systems. If you're doing something that's before the bottleneck or after the bottleneck, it doesn't matter how productive you try and be. Mm-hmm. The system's going to set the level, just like the fat kid sets the pace of the hike.
Yeah, your systems are optimized to get what you are getting right now. Right now. Yes. But so what I think is interesting on that last one, Ron, is that, I've been railing against this for a year because it's a big problem in outside project management as well. And that one of the things, if you go back to the show that we did on proper project initiation, we talked about this thing called the project charter. Yes. And the specific thing in that project charter is to ensure that both authority and responsibility is given in direct proportion to one another. That is the purpose of that charter, to ensure that the project manager is given both the responsibility and the authority to get stuff done, and that you don't have to keep running back to the executive sponsor for absolutely everything. And it tries to define what those things that we do have to get approval on are well defined and known up front.
And how many times that is when you, especially when you're relying on the customer for certain things, so you're kind of managing that their personnel as well, or a chunk of their personnel. How many times is it that the customer's the bottleneck?
That's right. Often. And that's another problem with the timesheet is that the prime sheet doesn't track that. Right. So if you're using hours worked, or, you know, the hours spent as your project management doneness tool, you've got only half the story in a lot of cases, especially if the customer is responsible for getting certain things done. So, yeah, it's a big problem. Big problem. Yeah. And here's the thing is, like, most project managers, even to this day, because I see this happen continuously, they don't do proper project initiation. It's not a hard thing to do. It doesn't take very long. They just go right up into planning, but they haven't initiated the project properly. They haven't gotten, okay, let's define who the authority and responsibility here. And it's mind-numbing because it's so easy to do. And I even recommend to people that they do it retrospectively. Like, even if even if you haven't gotten it up front, do it now.
Yeah. So, make it a habit for the next time. I was talking with Rick Payne about a full kit, you know, how you have to have everything before you start a project. And, you know, he's been recommending since the boot camp days, for crying out loud, that firms hire somebody who's knowledgeable. I mean, almost like, you know, like a CPA or a lawyer, to make sure that you have everything in the file before the work is commenced. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, we've got to hunt down the customer and get this thing, and we're not going to start the work until we have that.
So rather than a review or a previewer kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And he says, you know, the blowback you got, well, that's too expensive. That would add headcount. But yeah, but how much is it costing you to have your team pick up that file 20 times and email
start and stop
back
right.
and forth? And it's just a nightmare. So yeah, that's great. So yeah, productivity is not so much about your people, it's about your system.
Yep. All right. Well, this is a fun one. Our friend and former guest, James Harrigan from Words and Numbers podcast, wrote a story on March 29th, opening day of baseball, about baseball, beer, and a dog. And he's talking about the prices. Mostly he's talking about all of the things that are happening from pricing perspective inside baseball, so including tickets. But one of the things that he talked about was a hot dog. And he goes back 100 years ago, the average price of a hot dog was 10 cents. And the cheapest hot dog that he could find in the major leagues today was $2.75. So they're a little bit all over the map. The Petco Park is the most expensive, which is $7.75. And the league average for a hot dog is $5.32. So you probably know where I'm going with this, Ron, is I had to do what with this?
Throw it
through the abundance calculator and the time prices. Yep, absolutely. So here's what we did. So ballpark hot dog, 1923, nominal price a dime. Hourly compensation for the U.S. unskilled worker, 24 cents an hour. The time price of 0.42. The 2023 hot dog, ballpark hot dog, with a nominal price of $6.88. So this is what I was putting in, which is higher. What I was looking for in this particular one, Ron, was what is the one, right? What is the one? You know what? I should back up, because the way I did this is I actually first went to the and put in the time price that was current for $2.75. Found out that hot dogs are 2.5%, or the abundant multiplier is 2.5. So that you can buy 2.5 hot dogs if you are a unskilled hourly worker in 2023 than you could back in 1993. So indeed, no, hot dog prices haven't gone up. But I did learn something about the abundance calculator, and that is if you do take the abundance multiplier and multiply that by the nominal price, okay, that will automatically allow you to see what the, quote, time price adjusted. So think inflation adjusted. So this is now time price adjusted price is. So the time price adjusted price, where you're now your abundance multiplier is equal to one, in other words, is $6.88, which is below the average. And it's not – Petco Park is still more expensive at $7.75, but – there you go. So once again, time prices to the rescue on this stuff. And nope, it's not more expensive. Actually, not more expensive.
And Harrigan didn't make that point.
No, no.
Wow. And Ed, where do you get a 275 hot dog in the majors?
Let me see, we got to run, but it is in the article. Let me see if I can quick find it. $2.75. I can't find it. We'll have to wait until next week on that. But Denver is in Denver. Denver.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's coming up next week, Ed?
Next week, we are going to talk to Maggette Wade again. Her book is out, Heart of a Cheetah, our second review with Maggette Wade.
Fantastic. She's wonderful. I can't wait. I'll see you in 167 hours. This has been The Soul of Enterprise, Business, and the Knowledge Economy, sponsored by Sage, transforming the way people think and work, enabling their organizations to thrive. Join us next week, folks, on Friday at noon Pacific time. In the meantime, check us out at thesoulofenterprise.com for more information on today's show and future upcoming shows. Also, you can reach out to me or Ed at asktsoe@verisage.com. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a great weekend.